From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the middle of August 1995, a little company called Netscape made its debut on the stock market. Netscape's pride and joy was a piece of cutting-edge technology, a strange new piece of software called a web browser. When the dust of its first day on the market began to settle, Netscape was worth a staggering $2.7 billion. That was a wake-up call. And soon, the whole world was talking about the Internet. 10 years later, the Internet is a nearly escapable fact of life used for everything from reading books to booking flights to moving every sort of data and opinion. You can consume vast amounts of video, audio, text, interactive media, but we give back to the Internet, too. We publish our own words, ideas, sights, and sounds in what is looking more and more like a new neural network, in the view of some, a growing planet-wide mind. The universe and role of the Internet today is so big that we can already barely comprehend it, and it's just beginning. This hour on Point, 10 years after the Netscape drumroll, where the Internet has come and where it's headed. You can join the conversation. Can you remember the world before the web? And how do you expect the Internet will change our lives in the years ahead? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're going to hear a lot of great voices today. John Perry Barlow will join us. Esther Dyson, we're joined right now from Northern California, the most famous hub of the systems supporting the virtual world of the web, by Rich Karlgaard. He's publisher of Forbes magazine, author of Life 2.0. He writes about technology, entrepreneurship, and the future of business and work in his column Digital Rules. Rich Karlgaard, wonderful to have you with us. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, great to be with you, Tom.
Rich, we read your op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal. Looking back on that day, you had a great, I guess, apocryphal joke there about Jerry Garcia and the Grateful Dead and his last words. Share that with us.
Well, of course, it is apocryphal, but Jerry Garcia died on August 9th, 1995, and the joke going around the Internet within minutes was that his last words were, "Netscape opened at what?"
The great maestro of the Grateful Dead.
That was the joke around the net, because Netscape had priced in its prospectus an IPO, an initial price offering of $28 per share. But the demand was so great for the stock that when it finally opened, it opened at $71.
And so, as you say, the great gold rush began. But in a way, the most important thing there, Rich, was the way it turned the heads of the world. It focused public opinion everywhere very quickly on this thing that had been kind of subterranean. Now it was out. The big starting gun had been sounded.
Boy, it just exploded into the scene, and that started the great technology gold rush. People don't remember that the NASDAQ Composite Index on the day that Netscape went public was around 1,000 points. So there had been hot offerings before, but this really set off a 5-year boom that became a bubble by the end. And that, of course, was the original story. I mean, the skeptics, when the bubble finally popped in mid-2000, the skeptics piled on and said this Internet stuff was overrated, overhyped. And, of course, 10 years after, we have a much different perspective that while the stocks may have been overrated and overhyped, the Internet, if anything, has been underhyped for many of the reasons you talked about in your intro.
Rich Karlgaard, elaborate on some of that. Where you see the point we've reached now? How early, how nascent are we still in what will be the history one day of the Internet, and where is it headed?
Well, I think the most astonishing fact about the 10th anniversary of Netscape's IPO is the fact that it's only 10 years. I mean, think about the airplane in 1913. Think about the personal computer in 1984. It is fair to say that we are in the very early days, and we're only now beginning to understand what the potential of this new communications medium. It's really been only in the last handful of years, not the last 10, but the last 2 or 3, that most of us who experience the Internet through a broadband connection. And, of course, even in America, the definition of broadband pales compared to how South Koreans and Japanese and Finns and Swedes interface with the Internet. So I think we're going to look at the next 5 years when we get real broadband as the time in which the Internet went video. We're going to have voice over IP, which means we're going to make our telephone calls over an internet connection. So the first 10 years, as much as the net has changed the world, I think is only just hinting at the potential.
You write about how it's already come to have a real systemic influence. You make note of on the economy in particular, where you describe something you call the internet immune system, and said it's had a huge impact just in the last few years on how our economy has stumbled and stood up again.
Yeah, I think the internet, you know, for all the money that was lost in the internet when the bubble finally popped in 2000, the internet has more than made up for it in how it has given the American economy a kind of resiliency and immune system. What I talked about in the Wall Street Journal column was that late 2000, 2001, the American economy was hit by four major threats. There was a stock market collapse, particularly in technology. There was a recession. There was 9/11. And there was a really kind of incipient deflation brought on by, in my opinion, too many Alan Greenspan interest rate hikes. Now, normally, an economy faced with four blows like that would take years to recover. Think about the Great Depression, that started with a stock market collapse in 1929 and really persisted until the early days of World War II. This time, we got out of this trouble in a remarkably short period of time. And one of the reasons is that the internet caused a necessary event to occur, which is after a recession, you have excess inventory.
Mm-hmm. Product piled up everywhere.
And the internet forged new markets between buyers and sellers. It was very painful, but we got through the pain very fast. My favorite example of that was that Sun Microsystems, found in late 2001 and early 2002, that its chief competitor was its own year-old servers being sold for dimes on the dollar on eBay.
But you clear out that inventory, the economy stands up again, and presto, you see the internet as a kind of system, as an immune system, you say, that changed
the whole speed of economic recovery.
Is.
Yeah, it's an immune system in the sense that new markets are made and you get this clearing mechanism. In the 1930s, you know, that didn't happen. The reason that we used to call financial downturns panics, and we called the one in the 30s a depression because people were so depressed they didn't know how to make new matches between buyers and sellers, and the thing lasted a whole decade.
And here's a technology that turned it around in record time. Let me ask you something, Rich. Your magazine, your publisher at Forbes, I don't know if it still is called, but for a long time with Malcolm Forbes, it was called The Capitalist Tool. Now, I'm thinking about the internet and the degree to which it's made profit, not made profit, the degree to which it's dominated or not dominated by profit-making enterprises. There's an awful lot of communitarian activity on the web. Look forward with us. Do you see the internet, ultimately the internet, as a capitalist tool or a communitarian tool?
Well, I think it's both. I mean, I think it is chiefly a communications medium. And a communications medium can be used to to market products and to make new matches between buyers and sellers, and it can bring people together of disparate geography and common interests. So I think it is undeniably true that it is both. And on the communitarian aspect, I think Google and some of the leading lights on the internet are now concentrating their efforts on local search. Microsoft, in fact, thinks this is where it can check off Google's remarkable progress. Mm. I think that remains to be seen. I think that Google's got such momentum it's going to pose problems for Microsoft. But that really speaks to your point about communitarianism.
It's got a lot going on there. Rich, stand by for a moment. I want to welcome also from San Francisco, John Perry Barlow, retired Wyoming cattle rancher, former lyricist for the aforementioned Grateful Dead, co-founder of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Since 98, he's been a fellow at the Harvard Law School's Berkman Center for Internet and Society. John Perry Barlow, welcome back to One Point. Good to have you.
I never heard that joke, by the way, Rich.
It's a good one, Jerry Garcia.
Nobody thought it would be funny for me.
Yeah, it wouldn't be funny for you.
It's funny for me now.
Yeah, now after a little time. John Perry Barlow, I remember seeing you on television years ago, maybe this full 10 years ago now, talking about the internet emerging as a global mind. Now we hear a lot of talk about that. Is it happening?
Well, you know, it's happening in its own slow pace. I've had this vision since before I ever encountered the internet. I read Teilhard de Chardin when I was in college, and I thought, yes, there's going to be this new layer of evolution. So when I first encountered the internet back in 85, I thought, yes, this is the nervous system. Mm-hmm. We are wiring the nervous system for the collective organism of mind. And I still feel that way.
A tremendous idea, and we want to look more at that and the pace. Rich, I know we have to let you go in just a moment.
Which is a pity. I'd love to have a chance to talk to you. We never see one another.
Yeah, I haven't seen you since the glory days of the late 90s, John.
Yeah, well,
great to hear your voice.
We should make a point.
We'll try and get you both back on together soon. Rich, last thought to you. Pace. You say, you know, it's only 10 years in. We've just got half a minute here. The airplanes took a long time to come into their fullness. We thought the internet was supposed to move faster than all that old stuff.
Well, it is. I think that the broadband is really, you know, the pace of broadband dictates the pace of internet adoption and its full use and what it can become. And broadband, I mean, we could spend a whole session on that, just talking about the barriers to broadband in the United States.
And why the U.S. is falling behind.
That's the pace car right there.
The pace car on broadband. Rich Karlgaard, publisher at Forbes magazine, thanks for being with us this morning.
Yeah, thanks so much, Tom, and great to hear your voice, John.
John Perry Barlow, please stand by. Esther Dyson joins us in a moment and more. We're talking about the internet 10 years after its public starting gun, the Netscape IPO. Do you remember the world without the net? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this morning about the internet, 10 years after the Netscape IPO, where the net has come and where it's headed now. You can join us. Do you really remember the world without the net? Do you really remember how different it was when a universe of information and interaction was not always at your fingertips? And where do you see the internet going now, going next? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined this hour by John Perry Barlow from San Francisco. And John, you've lived in anticipation of this for a long, long time now, way before that Netscape IPO. What about your sense of the pace of how this is all evolving toward wherever we're headed?
Oh, I think it's coming along fine. I was never in a hurry about this. I assumed that, you know, among other things, it was going to have to require a renegotiation of all the power relationships that had been established over the last 400 or 500 years. So, you know, there was going to be a lot of lag in the system. For one thing, we were so used to broadcast media, and I actually viewed Netscape or Mosaic.
Mm-hmm. The browser.
Its predecessor.
Mm-hmm.
As being a step backwards, in a sense, because it, you know, it went back to the broadcast metaphor. Prior to that, the internet had been really a conversation.
But a much smaller circle of conversants than you saw within what seemed like no time at all.
I actually feel that it would have expanded exponentially in any event. The important thing was commerce could be involved. The thing could become graphical. One of the terrible things was that Andreessen decided to release Mosaic just before he made it fully interactive.
Mm-hmm.
I got on the World Wide Web, I think, in 92, at, you know, just after Tim Berners-Lee had created it at CERN.
Right. The and usable thought, face of the internet.
When I thought, this is really cool, except for the fact that, you know, it's all about high-energy physics, which interests me, but not at this level of detail, and it also requires a lot of heavy lifting.
Because at that time you had a lot of physics
line,
people who were on there and all the command stuff you needed to do to use it.
Yeah, it was hard. and I didn't have the necessary insight to realize that what was needed was something that would translate that into a point-and-click environment. But unfortunately, Mark Andreessen failed to take it all the way to a fully interactive medium, which is now, you know, with wikis and blogs becoming more interactive.
Is circling back around to what you imagined, what you first tasted?
Well, I mean, what I imagined is not something that I expect to be realized in my lifetime. But, you know, when I think about a precursor to what I imagine, I think about Wikipedia, for example.
The encyclopedia that everybody contributes to and
the
that's linked out to everything.
The encyclopedia that everybody makes and that is self-corrective. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think Wikipedia is a kind of miracle.
No kidding.
Truly, because it could be filled with nonsense, and it's not. Mm. Every time I look up something that I know something about, it's really spot-on accurate.
It is. It's incredibly solid. Let me ask you, John, about that vision of the global nervous system emerging with the Internet. Kevin Kelly, editor at Wired Magazine, is writing in the current issue on the same anniversary about a global mind or brain emerging, which sounds pretty close to what you were describing way back when. Paint that picture for us and how what you anticipate has changed or not changed since you first saw it in those terms.
Well, I still think that there is going to be a day some distance from here in time where every synapse, you know, every living organic synapse on the planet will be fully extended out to every other synapse on the planet.
Through?
You know, and at that point we will have a thinking organism sufficient, as Teilhard de Chardin said, of keeping God company.
This is human minds essentially... Well, all linked through the internet.
Human minds.
Mm-hmm. Kevin Kelly writes about the internet itself becoming a mind, already on its way to becoming a kind of active mind.
Exactly, and I think it's really probably a lot further toward being there than we're in a good condition to realize. I mean, for example, we have mitochondria in our cells, which have been pretty much in the same state since they were in the primordial goo. We just wrapped cells around them and then wrapped ourselves around the cells. We have an intelligence. The mitochondria go on doing what they're doing without any sense of what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it's possible that the net is already up to stuff that we cannot be sensible of.
That's happening in that universe is all
right.
This information.
That's as distant to us as our thoughts are to the mitochondria.
John Perry Barlow in San Francisco, if you could stand by for just a moment.
Sure.
I want to welcome another voice into our conversation. Joining us from New York City is Esther Dyson.
Hi, Esther.
Hello, Esther, are you there?
I have heard your voice in person recently. Nice to hear you. Better to see you.
Esther, a huge voice in the whole first decade of Internet development, now editor-at-large at CNET Networks. She's responsible for the monthly newsletter there, Release 1.0, and its PC Forum, a kind of high-tech market's leading annual executive conference. Esther, we've had Rich Karlgaard talking with us this hour and John Perry Barlow about where we've been, where we're going. What do you see the moment that the net is at now, the accomplishment of this first decade since Netscape and the future?
Well, it's one of those points where looking back you see 10 long years of achievements and looking forward you see, oh, we're only a tenth of the way to 100 years.
Yeah,
so
yes, the math is there.
Yeah, because it's really whatever it's doing it exponentially. The changes build upon one another, and I agree with John about this huge shift in the balance of power between individuals and institutions. I remember being a reporter for Forbes, and if you wanted information, you would call the company, and then you'd make a bunch of phone calls. There weren't answering machines and things, but there were secretaries.
Right.
And eventually, 3 days later in the mail, you'd get an annual report.
Right.
It's and there was really no way you could subscribe to LexisNexis, but we'd go back and look in these wonderful file folders of previous Forbes stories and little clippings and handwritten reporter's notes. And now I went to a dinner party last night, and there were about 20 people. One of the women there said, oh, yes, I Googled everyone here. And
it's godlike just, power.
Yeah. So she knew who we all were and what questions to ask and who she wanted to sit next to and I guess who didn't rate. And that's the intimate change in what – I was sitting next to this little girl on the subway this morning. She's going to go home tonight and she can write to another little girl in Japan. She can find out about the rainforests in Brazil. She can I am her friend next door. She can I am her mother who's probably still at work. The kids' expectations of what's normal have changed dramatically. Interestingly, in the past, kids would watch adult TV, but they were still kids. Now kids can go online, and unless they tell you, they get treated like adults. So you have these 11-year-olds who are running web development businesses.
And everyone's trying on different faces, different persona on the web. John?
But you know, Esther, you know, one of the things that you and I thought a lot about in the early days was the possibility that the individual would suddenly have power to confront the institutions. And I think that, you know, I mean, I confess that I was thinking about me as the individual. But, you know, what has happened, among other things, is that Osama bin Laden turns out to be an individual.
There are many kinds of individuals, you know.
But it is interesting. In the short run, a friend of mine just got one of these really stupid letters from United Airlines this morning saying that was a response that was completely unresponsive to his problem. And so they have sort of the form of interactivity, but not the reality. On the other hand, you now have people going, and instead of just selecting what they want from online commerce, they post their own wish lists. They negotiate with airlines. It's taking a while to happen, obviously, but you're going to see some airlines go bankrupt and others that are more responsive persist. So evolution works. It works slowly. But the challenge is, are we going to see that happen in politics and government?
And in what direction? Happening. I mean, Kevin Kelly writes that this is the kind of power of knowledge that kings went to war for in previous eras, the kind of knowledge that they'd tell fables about, you'd turn to Merlin for.
But, well, the great thing but no, is I mean, the real they knowledge don't know is, who to go to war with.
What is your government up to is the real challenge here.
I mean, they have a hard time attacking us.
They being who in this case, John?
Well, the powers that have been.
Mm-hmm. Oh, are you saying the king no longer knows where to go to grab all the info? The info spigot.
The front is.
It's everywhere.
Well, it's everywhere. The real thing is that the king's power is eroding, but Osama bin Laden isn't getting that power. He's got destructive power. He doesn't have constructive power, which is a pity. I wish he did. I wish he could build the ideal society, but. I mean, whether he wanted to or not, he can't.
Not so far. Esther Dyson, John Perry Barlow, I want to begin to bring our callers in, if we may. We've got a lot of them waiting to join us. Mark is calling from Nashville. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hello, sir. How are you?
Very well. What do you think?
Okay. Well, let's see. You had asked, if I actually remembered a time before the Internet. Well, certainly do. It was awful.
Why?
Well, how can I put it? I mean...
You were 2 years old.
I lived in I lived in quite a small town, and unfortunately finding anybody with the same sort of interests, and just fiction, music, all that sort of thing is quite difficult. But with the Internet, all of a sudden, I'm finding out about all sorts of authors I never knew, different bands, making friends, you know, on the other side of the planet. It's quite a nice thing.
Has it changed your own life of the mind?
My own life of the mind?
The life of your mind is the way you think. Changed by those interactions, the way you understand the world.
Well, sometimes I suppose I see an at symbol here and there, but I certainly do think a lot more globally in terms of that sort of thing. I mean, really, at this point, each person can become the media. As you were saying before, you know, at one point, what was it, a long time ago, during the WTO protests, they were saying they weren't using rubber bullets, and all of a sudden there's video on the Internet that they are. CNN has to update their story, so it's a way in which we can check people to make certain the truth is there.
And you can join communities of interest that are fully global, something, John Perry Barlow, you've talked about for a long time.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there's this possibility of all of us being able to present our case, regardless of where we are. I mean, the thing that has been the founding desire of EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and a lot of the people who got involved in the Internet early on, was that everybody who had anything to say would be able to say it, and nobody would be able to shut them up. And that everybody who wanted to hear something or learn something or exercise their right to know would be able to learn.
And but the challenge
I think we're actually headed there despite, you know, the obstacles of copyright, the obstacles of the powers that have been. We're heading there at a marvelously swift pace.
But yes, there's a challenge, as one of my Russians once said, yes, we have freedom of speech, but we don't have freedom after speech.
Exactly.
Right. Say what you will in all over the world, but then what?
Governments still exist, and governments still abuse people who exercise both their right and their ability to freedom of speech. And so the challenge is also people seeing role models and getting the courage to say, well, I will say what I think, and if there are enough of us saying it, they can't put us all in jail.
Esther Dyson, John,
You know, Esther, you bring up an important point, which is that, you know, we all have the right to speak now, and so we have, you know, a gazillion lonely pamphleteers on a gazillion lonely street corners saying whatever they want. But what we have not yet cracked is the ability to coalesce all those points of view into something will actually be politically powerful.
John, Esther, I want to bring one more voice in here, if we may. Joining us from Columbia, Maryland, Frank Hecker. He's director of policy for the Mozilla Foundation. Worked at Netscape on the day of that IPO 10 years ago this month. Mozilla is a nonprofit, develops and distributes the Firefox web browser, increasingly popular alternative to Microsoft's Internet Explorer. Frank, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
You were there on that day. What was the sensation, the shiver that went through Netscape when you saw what happened to that stock price?
Well, I worked in the government sales group at Netscape in the field, and I was actually driving around that day with a sales rep going on a sales call. So we weren't part of the ground zero of the excitement. We were hearing it from afar, just like everybody else. But certainly from our point, it was very exciting news, and not so much for the financial aspect, although that was interesting, but... Mm. But just validating the fact that we were part of a real company now that was making a splash in the world.
And 10 years on, you're now with Mozilla and Firefox and the rest. What does that say about where you think the Internet's going?
Well, I think one thing it says is that although Netscape as a company is essentially defunct, I think that the initiatives that Netscape started are still very much alive. The Firefox and Thunderbird browsers are really genetic descendants of Netscape's early products. They just moved into a new phase. They're now free open source products available to everyone.
Does it mean Microsoft's role, once envisioned so large by Bill Gates, is not going to be so large?
Microsoft is still important, but I think that the success of Firefox in particular has shown that people do want to have choice. People are willing to look at alternatives to products from Microsoft and others, and that so long as products like Firefox are successful, so long as products like the Apache web server and so on are successful, I think that will keep the web open and a great place for innovation that's not controlled by a single company.
Another big facet of the future of this universe. Frank Hecker, thanks very much for being with us from the Mozilla Foundation.
Thank you.
John Perry Barlow, Esther Dyson, please stand by. We've got to take a short break. We'll be back. We've got to take more of your calls. We're talking about the Internet 10 years after its public starting gun, the Netscape IPO. What do you think? What's the moment the Internet has arrived at now? And are we at that hinge point in human history? Is the Internet steadily emerging as the new global brain? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, BICON.com, and Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital, for more than 60 years helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services, in Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Internet, 10 years after its public starting gun, the Netscape IPO in August of 1995. John Perry Barlow is with us this morning. Esther Dyson is with us as well. You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. Gary's calling from, Dana is calling from Orleans, Massachusetts. Hi, Dana, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I'd like to go back to the idea that I think was Mr. Barlow. Do I have his name correct?
Yes, you do.
Oh, thank you. Okay, about the global mind and this human-directed evolution. I really am skeptical about. I like the internet. Don't get me wrong. I use it, but I do not see it as a form of evolution. This kind of techno-utopian idea, to me, I'm just very skeptical of it. I think history has shown that such utopian ideas really never work.
Are you skeptical about the world being woven together in this way, or skeptical that it will have a kind of utopian purpose?
I think more of a utopian purpose, the idea that our consciousness is going to expand because of the Internet, especially since, and I've noticed this today on your show, all your guests, as knowledgeable as they are all market ideologues.
I don't know. We'll have to do a little survey on that front. I'm not sure that's the case. I'm not sure what Frank Hecker would say. But let us pick it up, Dana.
I wouldn't even call myself a utopian at this point.
Yeah.
I might have been guilty of that accusation at some earlier point. But, for example, let's suppose that we're developing a global mind. Who's to say that that's going to be a good thing for us as human beings? It might have an entirely different set of opinions. For example, we have corporations, multinational corporations, which I think are another layer of evolution. Mm. I mean, they're creatures. And they're not necessarily good for humanity. So I'm not being utopian about this. I'm just saying that there's something going on that I think is an interesting, at the very least, process.
Esther Dyson, how about the light and dark here? There was a lot of utopian thought and language wrapped around the net when we first all started thinking about it together. What about now?
Well, let me just say one thing about the market. I prefer the market to intelligent design.
You want some natural selection out there.
It's evolution, markets, they're all the same phenomenon, which is small interacting things creating emergent larger structures that have some kind of meaning. And so I'm skeptical of this emergent mind as well, but it is, in fact, I think, what's happening in our minds. You have all these neurons interacting, and the real question is what jump creates consciousness. I don't know, but I'm open-minded about this.
And the parallel you're drawing there, again, like John has in the past, Kevin Kelly does in Wired, is that when you get enough of these internet linkages, that at some point you may jump to consciousness, is what we're toying with here.
I don't know when, and frankly, in terms of what I do, I don't pay too much attention to it, but I certainly think it's a reasonable theory. It's not one that has much evidence for it, unlike evolution, but it's something worth thinking about. What I wanted to go back and mention, though, is the interesting parallel between what Frank said about Netscape and Microsoft. Just as kings aren't replaced by Osama bin Laden, they're replaced by a different business model, which is large worlds and random terrorists. In the same way, Microsoft isn't being replaced by open source. Open source is a new business model that makes Microsoft irrelevant, but it's not another Microsoft. It's a different way of doing things.
Right. So what does it say about our relationship to market dynamics when you have that different way of doing things moving into town?
it says market dynamics are working, and
exactly.
the structure is evolving. These points, it's punctuated equilibrium, these points in time where a single company holds sway, previously IBM, now Microsoft, they are points in time. I think the hullabaloo now around Google, wonderful as they are, is illusory. They don't control the world. They reflect the world. But Google is only a point. You're going to see lots of other... The world is becoming fundamentally more fluid, more fragmented, more niche-y. The challenge is how to interconnect these niches so we get something meaningful that people can navigate.
Mm.
And
frankly,
in the world of user-generated content, even Wikipedia, to me, is one single point. What's more interesting to me is millions and millions of individuals with their groups of 13 friends. They don't need to become world famous. They're famous locally. And
John,
that's
you know,
the big change.
I think it's sort of, I mean, I know this is the premise of your show, but I think it's a bit of a misdirection to assume that there was some kind of really important break point on the day of the Google IPO.
Well, it's a starting gun. We look at it as public consciousness,
but,
I guess.
You know, and Esther, I think, had her own moments of revelation, and a lot of people did.
Mm-hmm.
That struck me as being a bit late in the game, and something that, you know, the conventional media could grab onto. But the really important stuff, I mean, the revelation that there was something very different going on here, a new social space, unlike any that the world had ever seen before, was something that I think had been building for a while and hadn't had a really obvious break point.
We're really looking at that airing, and it was old media who then grabbed onto these big numbers and beat the drum, and suddenly everybody was talking about it. Do you think, John, that the web itself has changed that dynamic, that revelations are
well,
clearly, they're
enough,
traveling on their own speed.
I mean, we're still focused on notions about what's real that are broadcast media generated. And, you know, as Esther was saying, and I think importantly, there are all kinds of things happening in what appear to be the margins, but if you add them up, they turn into a revolution. You know, it used to be that if you wanted to have a revolution, the first thing to do was to seize the broadcast media.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's more a matter of creating a wave that sweeps across a large space of consciousness.
Populated by an awful lot of individuals who don't own printing presses. Lynn is calling from Framingham, Massachusetts. Hi, Lynn. You're on the air.
Hi. Good morning. I was wondering if your guest could talk a little bit about the information and sifting it out and getting to the truth, which I feel is getting harder as we get more information. There was probably a time in history when I, for one, depended on a newspaper for the truth, quotes.
Right.
And now we can go online and find a zillion different takes on different truths. For instance, I think Wired magazine has a piece this month about blogs from the field in Iraq. And if you go there, supposedly you're finding out what really goes on. But so we would assume when we go on to these blogs that this is what's really going on.
But how are you supposed to know?
They're human beings writing these. You know, they could be...
Lynn, let us pick it up. Our time is short. It's interesting. I was looking at something written by Robin Sloan. Had this short film, Epic 2014, where he talks about the New York Times kind of shuttering. Its doors are going offline in 2014 because everybody everywhere is contributing information, true or false, to the web, and it just can't stand up to that wave anymore. Esther, what about Lynn's concern?
Well, first of all, you have to say, you might believe a blog, but would you believe your brother-in-law? And most of these blogs are written by somebody's brother-in-law. How the truth emerges, in the old days you had, quote, the official story. There was the received wisdom, and it was at least, if you like, fact-checked with official sources, and it may or may not have been true. Now you have lots of versions of the truth, and then you have everybody else criticizing them. And I have faith that, as with Wikipedia, the truth usually emerges. It may take some time, and erroneous rumors float around too, and people have authentic but misleading experiences, like your brother-in-law.
He As they use it second by second. We've just got half a minute left. John Perry Barlow, if we get to that global mind, is it a muddle in that case, or do you have confidence truth will out?
Well, I don't know what truth is, but I think the truth is what we all believe together, right? And here we have an environment where we can all believe something together and correct it as we go along. I'm confident about this. I mean, we're defining reality collectively for the first time, and I think that's a really good thing.
With that, we're going to leave it this hour. John Perry Barlow, wonderful to have you joining us from San Francisco. Thanks very much for being here.
Thanks.
John Perry Barlow, co-founder of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and Esther Dyson at CNET Networks in New York City, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, a look at U.S.-China relations after Chevron's successful takeover of Unocal. This is On Point. The oil giant Chevron completed its takeover of Unocal late yesterday, buying the American oil company for a reported $17.9 billion. The deal comes after Chevron's four-month battle with the Chinese state-owned oil company CNOOC. The prospect of China holding U.S. oil reserves was of great concern to some members of Congress and others who saw the efforts as a national security threat during a summer in which Congress proposed a slew of tariffs against Chinese imports and warnings from the Pentagon about China's military buildup. Will the Unocal deal, going the way it's gone, strain U.S.-China relations even more? We turn now to longtime China watcher Nicholas Lardy, senior fellow at the Institute for International Economics in Washington. Nicholas Lardy, thanks for being with us. What do you make of the way this has all gone in the end?
Well, I think it was quite unfortunate that the Congress intervened the way that they did, essentially blocking CNOOC's potential purchase of Unocal. The Congress set up procedures more than a decade ago for a review on the merits of all purchases like this, but in this case they decided to circumvent that process and simply put up additional barriers that caused CNOOC to withdraw its offer.
Remind us why CNOOC, which of course has a government money behind it there in China, why was it going after Unocal? What did China see? What did it want and need?
Unocal for the Chinese company was a very good fit because Unocal's most important assets, that is, its most important gas and oil fields, are actually in Asia.
Right.
And particularly on the gas side, and CNOOC is very interested in having long-term gas supplies because it's investing billions and billions of dollars to build LNG offloading facilities in several major cities to start using less environmentally polluting natural gas instead of coal and other sources of energy.
So if CNOOC had been successful in its effort to take over Unocal, would that have been an energy loss to the United States?
Absolutely not. China's going to be consuming the oil. If they continue to grow, their consumption is going to grow. And whether CNOOC is buying it on the spot market or has purchased the underlying oil fields or gas fields doesn't really have any net effect on the price or the availability. This is a very deep, fluid market, and owning a resource doesn't really change the ultimate supply and demand.
So what was the security objection then, or what was the nationalistic objection, describe it as you will, to CNOOC's takeover of Unocal?
Well, I don't think there was any plausible national security threat, and I think the members of Congress that were against this transaction recognized this. That's why they did not want the normal process they established more than a decade ago to work through, because they feared that the transaction transaction would be approved because there are no national security implications.
So what do you see as the source of the resistance that derailed this, essentially?
I think it's a complicated story, but I do. There are problems in the bilateral economic relationship. China has a huge trade surplus with us. They're not enforcing all of the provisions that they agreed to protect intellectual property. They have an undervalued currency. And I think this potential transaction by a Chinese entity buying a U.S. company was just kind of the straw that broke the camel's back, and it just created an outpouring in some segments of Congress trying to stop the transaction using any method that was available to them.
How do you think China, Beijing, is going to read this this mini-saga here? What happened with their effort to buy Unico?
Well, I think they will read it as an example of U.S. hypocrisy. The United States has been going around the world for decades telling countries they should open up their energy sectors to international investors so that American oil companies can come in. We're not allowed to operate in Saudi Arabia and a number of other countries. We have argued for years that we'd have a more efficient market, that we'd have better production, more assured supplies if those opportunities were opened up. And when a foreign company then wants to come and buy one of our oil companies, the Congress says, oh, no, well, you should let us invest abroad, but we're not going to allow you to invest here. So I think the Chinese will see it as hypocrisy, and they will also see it as anti-China, because we have allowed a number of other countries' oil companies to buy into U.S. Reserves and U.S.-based assets in this sector. So
in the half minute we've got left, Nicholas Lardy, what about the China-U.S. relation then going forward? Can we have this kind of posture toward China and have a hope of a mutually advantageous future or the expectation of it?
Well, I do think it's problematic. The Chinese are allowing, for example, Bank of America, other major U.S. financial institutions to buy into their biggest bank, something that that they were historically very reluctant to do. They have really completely opened up their market for foreign investment in manufacturing, and I think they see it as not a reciprocal relationship. So we preach the virtues of the free market and competition and so forth, but in this case, the Congress decided to impose special rules.
And a big, new, booming superpower is watching. Nicholas Lardy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Nicholas Lardy, Senior Fellow at the Institute for International Economics. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp by Lina Mata, Stefano Katsonis, Matt Lieber, James Ross, Christina Russo, and Karen Schiffman, with help from John Berger, Persephone Meal, and Angel Cozzelli. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.